and the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back. Thanks to Pat and to Gary West for their very gracious and helpful visits to kind of give us all what we needed to hear about both of their topics that we fleshed out yesterday. And Tony Black, who I've been remiss, we just couldn't get to Tony before or after Breeders' Cup. Tony, I'm sorry.
No, there's nothing to be sorry about. You had some great guests on, and when it comes to my handicapping skills and anything I could have added to Breeders' Cup, the listeners should appreciate I wasn't on.
That's not true. Why? Was there? Did you have bad opinions? You didn't have any winners?
You know how my handicapping skills are much not as good as my riding skills. And I always say when it comes to handicapping, if I never sat on top of them, I don't really do much good by just reading the paper and looking at the PPs. But you had some great guests on, and you know what? I listen and I learn from some of the people that you have on when it comes to handicapping. You had some great guests on through the Breeders' Cup. The only thing I haven't done is the last couple mornings I haven't listened, Steve, and I wasn't listening this morning. I started to go out to the track, and then of course I stay out there just for a short period of time because it's getting a little chilly, and I never minded the winter weather, but you know what? There comes a time where when you don't have to go out there and get cold, you don't do it.
Well, it's funny. I had that conversation. Specifically, actually, had that conversation with Mig about the cold that came up, and referenced you because both of you stayed, you both year round in the Northeast, your career. So, you powered through it.
Yeah, you know, there are people that complain about the weather, and it really at times it irks me, and some of the people are even in my family, like my brother. He complains about the weather, and he's moving to Panama or whatever he's going to do in the next few months. But anyway, I'm thinking, you worked inside your whole life. There would be no complaint that should come from you, where I worked outside since 1967. I was getting on horses and worked just about every year outside. And the winter time never was something that I complained about. You know, there were days that it was rough and you didn't want to go out there, the wet, the cold, the freezing days at times. But when the track was good and, it was in good shape for racing, I never really complained about being out there. And some of my best years that I had, winter time was where I was the most successful. And at times I used to laugh and thinking, what is it? Because I'm numb to the weather and I get out here and other people don't like it. Or was it just lucky? A lot of times I had very good winters. Never spent any time in Florida or California or any place in the wintertime. I can remember when my uncle was riding Sam Bolmitas, and racing wasn't year round. in the Northeast. You know, you had come Thanksgiving. Usually they were done racing by Thanksgiving or in that general time period. And, you know, they didn't start racing again till March or April of the next year. So, and he used to go to Florida. And his kids even went to Florida, and family went to Florida, and they would go to school up here until Florida, and they'd finish school down there in Florida. Yeah, so it's wintertime never really bothered me. I guess you get numb to it. I go out there now. A lot of times I'll be walking the dog or going outside in the wintertime and walking around and just have a light jacket on, and I'm thinking a light jacket. I can remember when all they had on was a turtleneck and colors. Hmm. But yeah, Mig knows. He was in New York. He knows what it was like to get out there. But you know what? We had to do it, and that was something we got used to doing. And then once in a while, I walk out the door now, and I say, you know what? I'm not going.
You don't have to. Exactly. You got that. You got that option. That's the good part. Let me ask you about your impression. We've had quite a, you know, basically a daily discussion about Flightline from every angle, you know, now for close to 2 weeks. Tony, you go back. You saw Secretariat getting getting smaller in front of you in the Derby and Preakness. What's your take?
I tell you, everybody wants to compare every horse, every great horse of that generation to another horse of another generation. And I'm thinking, you know, right off the bat, they started comparing Flightline to Secretariat. And it's not disrespectful in any way to Secretariat, and it's not in any way anything that could be proven. Anyway, you know, we're going to compare Secretariat. What are we going to compare him to? Citation. And
right.
And it's the way I look at it. It is. I state it like this: he's the best of his generation, and that's quite an accolade to say you're the best of your generation. You know, the best is tough to achieve sometimes. When people say, well, he might have been as good or better than Secretariat. I says, well, you know what? Flightline might well have been. But Flightline, what if he was a sham in a year that Secretariat was never born? Sham, what would we be talking about? Sham. Sham even beat Secretariat. Well, I think, what, in the wood he beat Secretariat? But maybe Flightline's a sham and he's not a Secretariat. We can't prove it, you know, but he's a great horse, and it's really exciting to watch him run. And in this time and era, you know, it's sad at times that we don't get to see these great horses run because of the economics of the game and breeding and everything after a certain period of time of their, you know, career. That's the sad part of racing right now to me, that you don't get to see him run. And look, we got to see Secretariat run a little longer than some of these other great three-year-olds and great horses that have come about. You know, and we saw Secretariat. He didn't like the taste of onions, and even got beat by Onion and Prove Out, you know. Sham was a great horse, maybe. Just a shame he was born the same year as Secretariat. So, you know, it's hard, and it's strictly a matter of opinion. And it's nothing wrong with people getting excited and having an opinion, you know, and saying, man, Flightline, he's another Secretariat, or he's better than Secretariat. You know, it's an opinion. You know, he's the best of his generation, that's for sure.
The biggest anticipation of the Classic was knowing that, you know, he was most likely going to, you know, stalk and encounter Life Is Good at a certain point. And, you know, those that were anticipating that would somehow be his undoing, they have had to sit back and you know, and reevaluate because that quote that it's funny, I've been on Twitter 10 years. That quote that Dave Grenick got from Rad Ortiz is the most liked and retweeted and you know, got the biggest impressions of anything that I've ever put out on Twitter. And I'm not, you know, I'm a modest, moderate, you know, moderate activity on Twitter. Got, I think, 600 likes and I don't know how many retweets, 100 retweets. When Rad Ortiz said that I knew I was going fast and I looked over and he was there, I said, oh, my God. He fully expected that he was going to outrun this horse. And then he said he went by me like nothing.
Yeah.
And he did. I mean, he went by him like he was tied to a post. Yeah. That says something.
Yeah, what better analysis is that than you could have? No better analysis than that when it comes to that particular race, or more than just so than just that particular race. But the feeling that a rider gets when he knows he's running fast and a horse comes past you like you're not even competitive, or you're to him, you're not even, you're that horse is out of your league. He runs past you like you're just an average horse, and you know you're on a horse that's running fast. You can't get a better opinion than that. You know, it's something when a rider can make that statement. And how many times do you get the chance to make a statement like that? Because how many times do you get a chance to compete against, or how many times are there horses like that you're competing against? You know, he's an amazing individual when he looks like he's not even running, and he's passing horses, you know, that are working and look like they're running. And here he's just got that stride and he's running past them. I mean, it was nothing any more exciting than, you know, Secretariat, when you watched Ronnie Turcotte and Secretariat winning the Belmont, and he was just widening every stride and it looked like he was just in a gallop, and, you know, and he's winning by a zillion lengths. I mean, what better opinion can you get from a rider that's on the horse? Like we've all said, you know, it's, you know, when you're on horses, there's a sensation that you get as a jockey on that horse. And a lot of times people will be looking and they don't understand the sensation that jockey is feeling while he's on that horse, you know. And it's something like that worn out statement that I used. It's not how fast you're going, it's how you're going fast. And you know who knows how you're going fast other than that horse? The jockey that's sitting on his back. He knows how he's going fast and how it feels, you know. And he's got that view of the horse's head and his ears pricking, and it doesn't even, and he might be going 21-44 and change, and then to that jock that's on his back, he knows he's going fast, but it feels like 24-48. You know, it doesn't feel like 21-44, because he feels the energy that horse is transmitting through his body to him. You can feel it. It's a sensation. And that's when riders, and myself especially, whenever I try to ride a horse and go against that sensation, you know, because I was trying to follow orders and following orders, you know, sometimes you get one dimensional in your thinking, and you say, I'm supposed to be third, or I'm supposed to be four or five lengths back, not on the lead. And you go to like maybe struggle to get that horse in the position that maybe the trainer wanted you to be in, or the owner wanted you to be in, or everybody wanted you to be in a certain spot except that horse. He wanted to be here, in front, pricking his ears and just kind of running relaxed and reserving his energy, but is in a position that's that he's not supposed to be in. Whenever you tried to go against that, you usually went against that horse's strength and his best run that particular day. And whenever I tried to follow specific orders at times, that's when I rode some of the worst races of my career. And if I went with that sensation, what I'm feeling at the time that I'm on that horse's back, and I went with the sensation, the instinct, it usually was better than trying to fight and get a horse in a position that he wasn't comfortable in being in that particular day.
Tony, one follow-up question for this. How much of a natural inclination or natural ability is that in a rider, and how much of it can be taught? How quickly do you in your education as a jock come to to understand that and be able to estimate how much that run is, how far that run is going to take you?
You know, I guess the greatest riders that we've witnessed throughout the years had it. It was a natural, something natural that they had. You know, they could feel it. They couldn't, didn't even maybe understand what they had. You know, it was just they had a good feel of horses and a good feel of what horses wanted to do and how they could control them with finesse and without muscle and strength. And, I guess some riders, and to some degree myself, I had to learn that. You know, it wasn't, there was a couple of things a rider like me had to learn. Had to learn how to handle anxiety, you know, put it to sleep. Don't let it waste you. Don't let it use your energy ineffectively and inefficiently. You know, and don't count on, I'll grab this son of a gun and I'll pull him down and I'll take a hold of him and he'll do what I want. You know, I had to learn that's not the best way to do it. And, you know, you learned it by watching maybe some of the greats ride. If as a jockey of my era had the opportunity to watch these greats, you know, and you know the names, I don't have to even name them. And then, you know, what came about, it taught me something that maybe my boss couldn't have taught me while I was under contract. But you started seeing more and more of some of these young ladies riding. Yeah. And these young ladies didn't always have that bicep and tricep and those legs that I had, you know. They weren't wrestling their way through high school. They weren't athletic from the time they were little kids trying to keep up with the bigger guys. I stayed fit when I was a little kid, just trying to keep up with the big guys so they didn't squash me. But these young ladies didn't have that opportunity, but they had something called finesse, and they had that light touch. You know, and it was that, let's say, kinder and gentler touch.
Yep.
And you got a lot of response, positive response from horses without putting that bit in their mouth and saying, I'll get this son, let you do what I want him to do. I got him, you know. No, they finessed them, and they used the light touch and the hands. And, you know, people talked about hands grow when I was growing up. You got to have good hands on a horse. You know, that's very important to have good hands. But you know who really had good hands and they really displayed it unknowingly were these young ladies when they started riding.
We've talked about that.
Yeah. The kinder, gentler touch, and it worked. And some of these brutes that I thought I was, strong, you know, athlete, started to figure out, you know what? It works a lot better their way than that way that I think I'm going to do it. Works better their way.
Tony, I got to go, but got to bring Neil in. But I want to wish happy Thanksgiving. And, of course, your mother, getting ready for what? Her 85th Thanksgiving?
Yeah, 97 years old.
It's unbelievable.
We were talking last night. She said, well, I don't want to put here's what she told me just real quick. She said, don't be getting one of those 20 or 25-pound turkeys. They're too heavy for me. I says, Mom, you're not lifting it. I'm the one who slipped in it. You're going to come and help me prepare it as we did last year and the last couple of years. So don't worry if it's 20 or we'll get a 15. I says, I'll get a 15 or 20. Don't worry about it. But all right. Happy Thanksgiving to all the listeners and to you. And you know what? I keep track and listen to you when I'm not on a horse's back. Sometimes even when I'm on a horse's back, I listen to you. But I learn a lot and I enjoy. You keep up the good work. Happy Thanksgiving. And then thanks for all you do, all the positive things you do and contribute to racing, Steve. Take care. Have a great one.
Tony, love you. Happy Thanksgiving to you, Kylie, the kids, your mom, and everybody. Tony Black, everybody, and outstanding. I mean, as many times as we're already have discussed Flightline, you hear, you know, Tony's insight and you know, there aren't too many people you can reach out to that basically, you know, we're riding against Secretariat in some of the biggest spots of Secretariat's career. But Tony was, and so he's got a unique, he's got kind of a, you know, a unique perspective. Speaking of unique perspectives, when it comes to Thanksgiving, how about a professional chef? How about celebrity chef? Certainly in horse racing, well, actually not to limit Neil Kleinberg's celebrity chef status to just the horse racing community, but he's certainly in the horse racing community. I think Neil, you're in the picture. You're in the picture with Bobby.
I doubt it.
That's not. Come on. What do you mean? What do you mean?
You know that he's on another level, but whatever. I mean, I'm honored just to be in his company regarding the horse racing community. Other than that, culinarily, you know, I'll probably kick his ass. It doesn't matter.
they were setting it up. This will be the opportunity, right? This will
no.
No.
You never know. You never know. Another throwdown might come my way. You just never know.
Well, maybe next summer at Saratoga. That, you know, we're going to rely on Gary for this. And by the way,
Well,
best wishes to Gary, who is recovering. He finally went in for the spine surgery. The lower back, you know, for those that have seen Gary suffering, first it was like a sciatic thing. Then it turned out that he needed spinal surgery. And he sent me a picture. Holy cow, it's scary. But the doctor said it went great. And that it should, I guess there was some fusion going on and some stabilizing and so forth. So a quick recovery and recoup for Gary. You'll see him striding right again, fit and ready when you see him later in the winter. Neil, this is always one of our most anticipated segments of the year. Clinton Street Baking Company's Neil Kleinberg helps you get ready for Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Steve. Best wishes to Gary. I've been texting with Josephine and giving him all our well wishes. And we'll have a nice lunch waiting for him in the backyard at Belmont because, you know, he's always good for a good sandwich.
That's for sure. And those black and white cookies you bring.
First, before we get started, can I do my impersonation of Andy Serling?
I don't know. Well, all right.
It'll be 10 seconds. Good morning, Steve. How are you? I've been up since 5:30, so I'm not yawning anymore.
You're fresh.
I'm sure you have too.
Even a little earlier, but he was funny. If you didn't hear Monday, I mean, he was funny. I mean, he ripped me for 25 minutes, and I at one point I was literally doubled over, and when the proverbial fell out of the chair, I was laughing so hard. I get that treatment, you know, off air two or three times a day.
You don't deserve it. He deserves to be muted.
Not at all. No. He makes me laugh as much. I mean, everybody has got friends that, you know, that one friend or two friends that just is funny and acerbic.
Doesn't
and
let up. That he, doesn't
it,
let up.
No, and he and it's funny because I mean I say I've known him longer than he acknowledges. I say it dates back to the late 80s. He says it's the late 90s. But I remember a few, you know, at Ciro's conversations. He makes me laugh like nobody.
Well, you know, it's not like the old adage, you can pick your friends, but you can't pick your relatives. It's the opposite with Andy.
Well, you can pick out a different size turkey. I've got to say, as we start this discussion, one thing, Neil, that did not come to pass, because earlier in the fall, they were carrying on like you were going to go to your market or your butcher or whatever, and you weren't going to be able to find a turkey. And that I don't know what that was about, because they're giving them away right now.
I know. It's just a lot of hype. I guess it's to get people either ordering them early, or everyone's in panic mode because of the supply chain shortage. But it's all a bunch of bull. Honestly, you know, my purveyors and farmers and people, I guess there was some sort of a scare where there was some bacterial infection and they had to kill a lot of turkeys. To stop the strain or something like that. But I don't really know too much about it. All I know is I've ordered my turkeys for myself and staff and family and things like that. And they're coming in.
I actually got two myself. I got an 18 and a 16.
We order our turkeys from Heritage Foods, and Heritage supplies us with a lot of our pork products, our great ham and pork chops and things like that. But they also have a phenomenal program with their Heritage Breed turkeys, which kind of looks a little scrawny on the breast side
right.
when you compare to like a butterball, but they are just magnificent flavored birds. They are, you know, free roaming, free range, corn fed, raised naturally and raised, you know, under really good conditions. And they are a great breed because the dark meat has kind of like a little bit of a, I would say a little bit of gaminess, which I like. And the breast meat is always really nice and moist and really, really flavorful. So I've been sticking with that brand for years, and I love it. And this year, as I told you last night, I was going to spatchcock it, which is taking out the backbone and then butterflying it, but keeping all the breastbone and everything intact, and then brining it. And I've been doing a lot of reading and a lot of observing other chefs and other restaurants and what they do and how they do it. And this year, I'm feeling like I don't really want to be looking in the oven every 20 minutes and basting a giant bird and then, you know, having to set it out on the counter to rest and then carve it at the table. I think those days are gone. What do you think?
I completely agree. And in fact, most of the periodicals right now, in terms of their approach, you know, there's plenty of conventional roasting going on, full bird. But I know, for instance, I think it was Bon Appetit talked about cutting the bird up pre-roasting and, you know, cutting the cooking time down, you know,
yep.
a great deal, lowering the risk of drying it out and also,
yep.
You know, improving, you know, even improving the presentation. And there's a lot of benefit. And you started talking about the spatchcock concept, maybe what, you know, two Thanksgivings ago.
Right. Well, the greatest thing about it, Steve, is that when you roast it and it's butterflied, every single inch of skin gets crispy.
Yes.
And that is brilliant when it comes to, you know, separating the skin and maybe, you know, carving it and then putting it back or having every single bite with a little bit of that delicious skin. And I know you like to do like a garlic butter under the skin,
yes.
and I like to do an herb butter under and over the skin. I know there's a lot of people I was even reading the other night of Jacques Pepin's memoir of his chicken book. It's all of his recipes and experiences in life with chickens. And one of his famous dishes, like in the 60s, where he would take like a giant knob of butter, put it in the middle of a chicken, roast it, then use that butter after it all melts out with the chicken fat and baste it over the top. Mm. And those kind of things really enhance the crispiness of the skin, what the actual bird absorbs in flavor. And you just can't beat it. I also saw a few recipes with like mayonnaise, which I'm kind of against. And they say that the mayonnaise keeps everything moist and absorbs into the flavor of the bird. I'm not a big proponent of that. I like simple, you know, a butter rubs, lots of salt and pepper. As you said, herbs under the skin, garlic, parsley, thyme, sage, rosemary, all of those fall herbs that enhance the flavor and build flavor. So I think we should talk a little bit about building flavor in every dish, because that's really what it's all about, is the taste when you sit down to eat it, right?
Very much. And of course, you know, part of our conversations are always trying to help people, you know, with their, you know, with the challenges. I mean, I say every year, there is no greater challenge for the, you know, the home chef than Thanksgiving
right.
dinner. That does not
That's
mean,
true.
That doesn't mean, though, that it has to be anxiety laden, and you know, all it takes to eliminate that portion is planning, and you know,
that's true.
A very careful, you know, making a list of what you're going to be making, making sure you've got everything, you've thought of everything you need to have on hand.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing worse than Wednesday night. Oh my God, I forgot.
Well, you know the French saying is mise en place, mise en place, mise en place, mise en place, which is having everything at your fingertips that you need to make a dish, and it doesn't matter what it is. Absolutely, the most helpful thing that I can tell people out there that are making Thanksgiving is do one thing at a time. One dish at a time. Let's say you're making sweet potatoes, right? And forget about everything else, because it'll cloud you and make you nervous, and you'll be thinking, oh my God, I still have to do the cranberry. I still have to cut the bread for the stuffing. What? No, focus on the sweet potato. Peel them, cut them in the size you like, season them, put them in a pan, put the seasonings you like on them, whether it's maple syrup or butter or cinnamon sticks or marshmallows, whatever it is, and then get that set. And then wrap it, cover it, and put it away. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Each individual item. And then, like you say, check off your list. Sweet potato, done. Then the next thing, go to the stuffing. You need to dice your celery and your onions and carrots and herbs and rosemary chopped and garlic chopped and all of the things chopped. And then you need to do your bread, whether it's sourdough or cornbread. You need to cube it and toast it and cool it. And then you need your stock on the side, and then butter or your fat to render out the vegetables. When you're doing those kind of things, you're building flavor, right? We're taking our mirepoix, our vegetables, whatever you decide, and herbs, and we're sweating them in butter or olive oil or chicken fat or whatever. You're building that layer of flavor. Then you're adding your bread. And the bread has been baked and then toasted, so it's crisp. And then it has the opportunity to meld with the vegetables. And then your next level is you add your stock and your salt and pepper. And then you can put it away in a casserole dish, and it'll build even more flavor for the next day. And then all you have to do is uncover it and bake it in the oven. And may need a little tinkering, right? It may need a little more chicken stock. It may need a little more butter dots on the top. It may need a little salt and pepper. And those three or four things are building flavor, and it's going to be phenomenal the following day.
Touch on as you laid that out, Neil Kleinberg with us, of course, from Clinton Street Baking Company, our annual Thanksgiving advance, and you know, Neil's expertise and you know, hardly limited to you know the what Clinton Street is famous for, of course, breakfasts. Neil, in terms of getting things done days in advance. I mean, we've got a weekend coming up.
Right.
You got Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. There are certain things that I'll do. I've got my Nantucket cranberry sauce, which Tina just loves. I can make that as early as Monday or Tuesday. And
totally.
It sits in the fridge. I got the zucchini
yep.
bread. I'll make, you know, two or four loaves. But this year, four loaves because we've got probably a dozen people. I'll make the zucchini bread, which... you can just freeze. I can throw in the freezer and take it out Wednesday, you know, evening, and it's going to actually. It's even in some cases. Actually, it's actually even better,
right?
Because it's crisp. It's funny. It's a very funny recipe. It comes from the Kropotkins, the New England Country Inn cookbook.
Okay.
Which is absolutely the greatest. When it comes right out of the oven, it's very crisp. Then you know when I Ziploc them. Overnight, the next morning, if I do them Wednesday, it's all soft. All the crispness gives way, which you know to me is preferable. But if I want a crisp, I'll put it in the toaster. Tina toasts it Friday
well,
and Saturday.
That's a good point. Very similar to our cornbread, right? We do jalapeno cornbread for our fried chicken dinner. We sell jalapeno cornbreads at the window on the bakery side. This recipe that I have and that I've been doing for years is a classic, really moist cornbread with a few slices of jalapeno on the top baked in and a fine dice of jalapeno in it. So you get that sweet from the corn, you get the spicy from the jalapeno, and then when we make them individually, it's perfect to reheat it in the oven and then, or even in the toaster with a little jam and butter on it, because you get that crispness on the outside and you still retain the moistness from the buttermilk and the butter and the eggs and the cornmeal and all of those other ingredients. Very similar to the zucchini bread, which has a lot of moisture in it and it holds its moisture. Yet when you toast it, the outside gets crisp. So any thing like that, if you're making, you could definitely make it a week before. Wrap, cool it, freeze it, let it thaw out on the counter, and then do whatever you want with the day of.
Gravy. You know, one of the reasons I got the two birds, I'm going to do the roast one, and I will, you know, I'll basically have the two breasts, you know, prepped and sliced and ready, you know, for Thursday, in addition mm-hmm. to the one I'll cook Thursday morning. But one of the reasons I'm doing that second bird is I've struggled nonstop year after year with gravy, and I read some advanced gravy concepts. I ask you this every year because I'm for whatever reason, I mean I'm not a saucier by any stretch. So
right.
Give everybody and it you know invariably it's a last minute. Thing and it doesn't have to be. You can absolutely make gravy, freeze it, and
yep.
bring it back up on Thursday. You know, so that it's not a panic stricken lumpy disaster.
Totally. Listen, this is one of my fortes, and what I love to do. And again, it's back to like the building flavors today. This morning, I was doing my laps at the pool, and when I have some of my best cooking and baking and restaurant and dishes, you know, stuff that comes through my head while I'm doing my laps in the pool underwater. I have these like great euphoric moments. And what I was thinking about this morning was the gravy and the stock. So just to give you an example, today is Thursday, right?
Yeah.
Tomorrow, I'm going to be making a big 5-gallon bucket of chicken stock from all the bones from our chicken and whatever. And since I'm spatchcocking the turkey, I'm going to take the backbones of the turkey and hack them up and add it to the chicken stock and make a very flavorful base. You can do that today and then cool it overnight and even keep it in the fridge or freeze it. And then the day you're roasting your turkey, that'll be your base for your gravy. And the simplest way, Steve, for me to make a gravy, and what I usually do is have that stock ready. When the turkey comes out of the oven, skim off some of the fat and use that fat with some flour to make a bernaise or a roux or a loose roux, and then just keep it on the stove and add your stock slowly and simmer it all afternoon. I like to do that because then I might add a half a clove of garlic. I might add some of the vegetables that came out of the bottom of the turkey pan. And then I'm like still building flavors, right? I have a nice sauce pot on the back of the stove, very low, with the stock, with the thickening of the roux, and then some of the vegetable particles. And then like an hour before we sit down, I'll strain it in a simple sieve or a strainer, and then put it back on the stove and tinker with it, a little salt and pepper, a splash of white wine, whatever. And then it's been on that stove for a few hours. It's been strained, and it's smooth as silk. And if I don't believe in a very thick gravy, because I think as soon as you put a gravy on the turkey, it's melding with the mashed potatoes and sweet potatoes and Brussels sprouts or whatever else you have. So it doesn't have to be thick. But it should have some viscosity. It should have a little bit. It should be able to coat the back of a spoon.
Yeah, well, that's
always. And it doesn't also, Steve, it doesn't have to be very brown. It can be light. It can be tan. It can be, you know why? Because you have the flavor of that base of the chicken stock with the turkey bones in it that you've made a week ago that is still developing flavor and is very savory and very, you know, it's very complimentary to all of the other flavors on that plate.
Got a question. I want to get a couple of the questions in that have come, and feel free on Twitter or email or whatever to add to our question list. The one and only Freddie Mo. Freddie asking back to your brining of your bird. Are you doing it wet or dry?
I was thinking about that today. I think I'm going to do it wet, only because I have the space and I have these buckets and I can really control the flavor of the brine. And basically, it's just salt, sugar, water, a few bay leaves, a bunch of thyme, a couple of cloves of garlic, not even peeled. And just, again, creating that base that will absorb into the turkey and give it moisture and some flavor. I'll take all of those ingredients and I'll bring them to a boil. And then I'll cool them and not even strain it. And then throw the whole turkey or the spatchcock turkey or the bone, even a breast or legs or wings or thighs, and then just put them in the brine. 24 to 48 hours, then drain them, pat them dry, and that's really all you need. The brine is imparting some flavor, moisture, salinity, a little bit of sweetness to the bird.
The times that I've done it, and actually the first time I ever did it was I talked this morning about the turkey we smoked in Montreal. Which is a big bird, and it basically was kosher salt, celery, onion, a lot of citrus,
huh.
orange, lime, and lemon.
That's cool.
Star anise, I remember being in that recipe, and perhaps something else or two. Anyway, same thing, boil. For those that are saying, you know, how do I do this? You take garbage bag, the biggest garbage, heaviest garbage bag you can find. If you've got a cooler, if you've got, a good size cooler, you
perfect.
Put the, once the brine is cooled, You put it in there. You put the bird in the bath. You tie it up tight so that all the brine encompasses the whole bird. And certainly in the Northeast anyway, you can keep it on the side porch, the back porch. I've got a summer kitchen, and it's cold enough back there. Part of the problem is some people don't necessarily, Neil, have a refrigerator big enough to do this. So
that's true.
That can be a little problematic. But if you have if you have those options, it is worth doing, and you actually end up with a very copious amount of liquid that comes out of the bird too. You end up with more post roaching roasting. You end up with more to make gravy and whatever you do with the stock.
Well, that's a good point, Steve. If you don't have, if I'm upstate this Thanksgiving, I'll throw, and I'm brining upstate, I'll throw it in a cooler in the garage and then keep it there overnight. And people that don't have that luxury or that big giant stock pot to put the turkey in or something like that, the dry brine is also really good. And basically, it's like kosher style poultry.
Right.
They rub the inside and the outside of the cavity with kosher salt. They sit it for a day or two, and then they rinse it out and pat it dry. And also that salt is getting absorbed into the cavity and into the parts of the turkey, and it's retaining the moisture instead of bleeding it out. And that's another way to do it. I mean, and if you don't have a day or two, it can be for a few hours. You could brine your turkey by crusting it the outside with salt and then the inside as well, and then covering with some plastic wrap or foil and leaving it out before you go to roast it, and then rinsing it and patting it dry. So there's many ways to do the brine. There's the dry one, there's the wet one, there's the 2 day, is the 1 day, is even 10 to 12 hours you can do it and still impart moistness and flavor into the bird.
Neil Kleinberg with us, Clinton Street Baking Company. And Neil, let's touch on some of the other questions. Our friend Todd Engel asked the other morning when I mentioned you were going to be here. He has to do a vegan or vegetarian Thanksgiving. And of course, Thanksgiving is already very vegetarian friendly.
Totally.
Suggestions.
People come to Clinton Street and they come for brunch and breakfast and dinner and lunch, and they ask sometimes, can I get something vegan? Can I get something vegetarian? I said, there's a lot of components on our menu that if you order them a la carte, you can create your own great vegan meal. An example, sauteed mushrooms for our omelet fillings. You can get a side of them. Spinach, sliced avocado, any of our sauces, our pico de gallo for our fish tacos, or our honey Tabasco for our fried chicken. All of those items are vegetarian. Most of them are vegan. If you don't have eggs in something or don't have a stock in something, you can always use, a vegetable stock, put mushroom stems and celery and carrots and onions and fennel and herbs and spices and, even, like you said, star anise. You can build flavor with spices and things that are not meat or eggs or dairy. So, for instance, we're doing green beans almondine this year. So I'm going to blanch my green beans. If you're vegan and you don't want to use butter, then you can use olive oil and saute your green beans and toast some almonds. And what better, flavor profile do you want than a delicious fresh bean? Or you can do it with Brussels sprouts as well, or you can do it with zucchini, where you saute them and add some toasted almonds and a little olive oil. And like you even said, a little citrus is beautiful. It's a counterpart to all the other flavors going on, the savory stuff like stuffing and mashed potatoes and things like that. So that's vegan. Cranberry sauce is vegan. If you're not using sugar, you can use honey. If you're not using honey, you can use agave. again, building flavors in things like the cranberry sauce with zesting citrus, like you said, lime, orange, lemon. All of those things are vegan. And there's many, many, many things, especially the side dishes. Anything with potatoes, sweet potatoes. Again, Brussels sprouts, there's so many ways to prepare them. We've talked about it before. The leaves, just simply sautéed. Roasted in a pan until they're very crispy and dark, and then glazed with, Steve, anything. Pomegranates, pomegranate molasses, balsamic vinegar, hazelnuts.
Nice.
If, you know, things like that. That are in your pantry, or they're in your cupboard, or they're in your vegetable drawer, are just perfect accompaniments. And everything I mentioned is vegan.
There you go. There you go. And it's funny. It's funny that you hit on the agave or molasses question and that option, because Fred actually came back with a inquiry about molasses, yes or no, in. In cranberry sauce. I've got that Nantucket. I'll put this up. I've got a Nantucket cranberry sauce recipe that I introduced about, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, that Tina, it's completely gotten her away from canned jellied cranberry. She absolutely, she requests it over the course of the year.
Right.
Doesn't even, you know, she doesn't even wait for Thanksgiving. In fact, I made it, well, I had that mock Thanksgiving in October, but, you know, people think cranberries are tough to work. It's the easiest, maybe the easiest thing to do. You throw them in, you boil them and you know, with orange juice and molasses and a few flavors and you know, they pop, wait till it thickens, refrigerate, and you've got something so much better than anything canned or you know, jarred. I still do the Jell-O, my fabulous Jell-O mold that my mother, you know, she passed on the Tupperware to me. And I knew you.
If I had bet $1,000, I knew you'd bring that mold up.
It's the greatest. It is the absolute greatest. And people that have never had it, they go crazy. But the Nantucket cranberry sauce, I mean, that's a winner. Are you a molasses user or no?
I'm not, honestly. I think molasses only belongs in a few things, like barbecue sauce or something that can handle that
the depth
of flavor, and it always has to be with something that's stronger than it, otherwise it overtakes something. But I totally agree with you on the cranberry sauce. It's the easiest, most ridiculous thing because it's so simple, and literally you can put that sauce together in 5 minutes as soon as they pop. What's cool about cranberries is that they have that natural gelatinous component where when they pop, they thicken it for you automatically. You don't need cornstarch. You don't need any thickeners.
Yes.
As long as you don't put too much orange juice or too much water or too much sugar in it, it'll naturally thicken. And then also, once it does and once they pop, you can adjust. You can wait till it cools a little bit and then see the flavor profile you like, whether you like it a little more sour or a little sweeter, or then maybe a touch of molasses or a touch of red wine vinegar or a touch of honey. So
I'll give you one. Wait a minute.
It's okay. Go ahead.
Here it is. In fact, I'm going to give the recipe because this is how easy.
Maple syrup.
Maple syrup is correct. Maple syrup is 100% correct. And this is how easy this recipe is. You're going to take a measuring cup. You're going to put a cup of orange juice. You start with a cup of orange juice, a quarter of a cup of maple syrup, a quarter of a cup of light molasses, 2 tablespoons brown sugar, 2 tablespoons of butter, quarter of a teaspoon of salt, and just 1 12-ounce package of fresh cranberries, the bag of cranberries. That is it. Combine those first 6 without the cranberry. Combine those in the saucepan. Get everything melted and mixed. Bring it almost up to a boil, but you know, basically get the sugar to dissolve. then...
I have an idea. Hold on.
Go ahead.
Change the moniker on your show. It shouldn't be Steve Bick at the races. It should be Steve Bick in the kitchen.
In the kitchen. Well, that's going to be maybe the
the next show.
Yeah, the next show, or maybe a once a week Saturday thing. I don't know.
No, Steve, you're right. It's as simple as that.
Yep.
And when you're doing things like that, right? You just explained the recipe on making it. So if you went into the kitchen tomorrow and you made that cranberry sauce, that cooled and put in an airtight container in the back of the fridge is ready for Thanksgiving. All you have to do is put it in a bowl and put a spoon in it.
Correct.
Done.
Exactly.
So
right.
There, out of the 10 components of your whole Thanksgiving meal, you're now 9.
Exactly.
And then any other dish that you complete and that you've thought out, there are a couple of things that you need to do a la minute or closer to the, you're not roasting the turkey the day before, but there are so many things that will help you not stress and not get nuts about how am I going to do all of this. It's really about being calm, taking it one by one, taking it step by step, and enjoying the process too.
Yeah, you want to spend time with family. You don't want to be the guy in the kitchen or the gal in the kitchen that doesn't get a chance to see everybody. And and then of course later when you eat, you're also worried about whether the next layer. We'll get to dessert in a second. Yeah,
right.
There's whatever you can do to cut down on the day of. Work and so you're not exhausted. I mean, by the time you get to dinner, your tongue is hanging out.
No, you need to pace yourself, and you need to parse it out in the course of a few days, and not get yourself so wound up that you're exhausted by the time. You know, there was a funny article in the New York Times on Wednesday about Ina Garten.
Yes,
how she's using all of these pre-prepared products to help you with Thanksgiving. And we've talked about this for many years about, buying sourdough bread diced and toasted, or buying something, or buying your vegetables minced so you don't have to be in there chopping celery and onions if you don't want to or you don't have the time. And then... So it was a good article. It was a little vague and it was a little weird. And at the end, they said, so what are you doing for Thanksgiving? And she says, oh, we're going out to eat this year. And I'm like, holy shit. This whole thing about saving time in the kitchen, and this year they're going out.
Well, on that topic, and I'm glad you brought up, the au courant, as you say, food writers of the era, because I can never have this conversation or discuss Thanksgiving without paying tribute essentially to the woman that made the Thanksgiving dinner as we know it an institution in America, and that's Clementine Paddleford. And she, her defining tomes on American cookery and the heritage of American food is really what made Thanksgiving between the wars, basically made Thanksgiving what we know now. And that leads me to a question, because she posed in her book, and I've got, I don't know, four of them. They're all sort of basic. They all have a central set of recipes, and then there's some that have got more regional recipes and so forth. But I think it's the Treasury of American Cooking is the giant Paddleford book. She suggested, Neil, and I bring this up with you every year, the introduction of a new item. I mean, every family has got their favorites and the perennials that are going to make the table every year. But she suggested making a dish every year, a new dish that is going to be basically introduced to the family and to the table. And there's going to be dishes that are overwhelming hits. And like the Au Gratin for us, took over and beat back the Mashed.
Got it.
I did one of her famous, most famous recipes is Mrs. Dayton's glazed onions. Tina had been asking me for the Cipollini onions.
Yep. Yeah, love those Cipollini onions. Yes, I love those.
Cooked down and glazed. So I made that for Tina 1 year, and she was kind of meh. She was like, "Okay, they're okay." She was trying to remember something that her mother or her grandmother used to make in Bennington. I got to go to Bennington for a haircut today. Last year, I made Savannah red rice from from Mrs. Wilkes. And it was a hit. And so it's a two-part question, Neil. How much tinkering, how much actual tinkering do you suggest? Mm-hmm. Is this a concept that you would incorporate? And because the red rice had some zip to it, and I did test a spicy a Cajun green bean recipe recently from the wonderful Jubilee. Have you seen the Jubilee cookbook?
I haven't.
It's a treasury basically of black cooking and in America. And this was I was shocked at how spicy it was, because ingredient wise, it didn't seem like it would be all that hot, but it was. So it was a little, I thought, too spicy for a Thanksgiving table. How spicy should anything be on the Thanksgiving table? And how much tinkering do you do yourself year to year?
Well, you know, the spicy thing is, it's more of a personal taste. I think the millennials and the younger generation, my older son Alex and my old daughter Michelle, and then my younger daughter Jade, they like spice. They can handle spice. And then there's my father-in-law, he's not into like too many onions or garlic or spices or things like that because he can't handle it. And I love things hot. I think if there's one component in your dinner, then people have a choice to have it, taste it, use it, or not use it. For instance, like our jalapeno cornbread, some people, really love it because they love the spice and getting a nice thin slice of jalapeno in their palate and opens it all up. Or a honey Tabasco for our fried chicken, or even for a chicken dish or something like that. People love the sweet and the hot. I'm not, when I'm making a classic marinara or a pasta at home, I'll be a little bit judicious with the hot red chili pepper. I like a lot of it. I like a fried Diablo. I like that. But a lot of people don't and can't handle it. So during Thanksgiving, I like to maybe have one item or two items as a choice, as a little spice that they could either apply or not. As far as new dishes, I always kind of think to lighten up the Thanksgiving, I would like to do a salad, whether it's greens tossed in a beautiful dressing, like a bib lettuce salad in a really nice sherry vinaigrette, or even roasted beets with a little balsamic and olive oil. I always think those a cold dish or a salad, even though we wind up saying no one ate the salad, the next day we'll eat it, or we'll eat it with a turkey sandwich. I always like that because it plays a part in texture, it plays a part in temperature, and it also gives a little freshness to the meal.
Beautiful. Well, that gets us to the back end as well, Neil, and your dessert philosophy. And of course, for years we've had the pies, the great pies from Neil, his pecan pie especially, and his apple and the biscuits. What talk about breads and talk about desserts?
Well, right after the pandemic, we got some phenomenal equipment at Clinton Street, and we're doing our own bread program now. Years ago, I used to buy, my sourdough from Pain d'Avignon, and my seven grain from Eli's, and my baguettes from Tomcat. We're making everything in-house now at Clinton Street. So I'm making our own sourdough. We're doing a beautiful pan sourdough and a free form. We're doing our own seven grain, which is amazing, with a whole wheat sourdough starter, has sunflower seeds and oats and honey. It's an amazing bread. We're also experimenting with some baguettes. I've almost got it down where we're going to be selling our breads at the window on the bakery side. So as far as breads go, I'm going to use our own sourdough for stuffing, of course, our sage and onion and stock and sourdough croutons. We're going to, of course, have our biscuits. But I've been really into bread these days. And my wife said to me the other day, if you bring one more loaf of bread home, I'm going to fucking kill you. So I've been into breads, and that's my thing. And it's so rewarding to make your own bread and to let things rise and to make sourdough starter and to incorporate it into dough and to work with dough and shape it and watch it develop. And, you know, you'll see, if you're on Instagram, you'll see a lot of sourdough people, you know, posting their stuff. And it's just, it's very rewarding when you make something and you let it take its time and you develop a bread and it comes out of the oven. There's no better feeling.
No.
So that'll be, you know, that'll be on our table in many forms. And then, of course, the pies. I have a very hard time veering away from the classics. The apple crumb. Our crust is very special. Instead of ice water in our crust, we use very cold milk. And it gives it a nice, tender, more nuanced flavor, along, of course, with a lot of butter and a little bit of shortening for flakiness. So those things is very difficult for me to either stop doing. And our maple bourbon pecan is I love because of the amount of bourbon in it that you taste. But, of course, the alcohol gets burned off, but you have a really beautiful bourbon flavor. And I don't use a lot of eggs in my pecan pie because I don't like that gelatinous gooey, too much corn syrup,
right,
too much eggs in that. I like it more pecan and a little chewy and a little nutty. And then we have our pumpkin, which of course everyone loves. I'm not a huge pumpkin fan, but we incorporate melted butterscotch into it.
Ooh.
And I think that gives it a great nuance. And of course, whipped cream, schlag, vanilla ice cream. How do you avoid that?
Where's my father when we need him? First Thanksgiving without my father. They love the schlag, boy.
Oh, my God.
For
that's
those,
the greatest.
It's ice cream. We'll have,
we'll have a scoop of schlag for him in memory of him, Steve.
Absolute.
All right.
I will mention this since my dad came up, too. Thanksgiving is a perfect place to trot out certain forgotten classics. And the last time he came up here, actually, I surprised him with something. That was his absolute favorite. And he hadn't had in years. And that's a baked apple.
Wow.
Baked apples.
Oh, that's sweet.
And I've actually got two fall options. I got a poached pear recipe, which is great for Thanksgiving. And these baked apples with raisins, with golden raisins. And they came out. I wish I had a photo. I mean, they came out so perfectly because it's a potchke. Let's not kid ourselves. Baked apple, if done right, and you got to attend to them, and you got to baste them a little, you got to watch them. But he was so delighted, and my mother used to make them.
Sweet.
Yeah, that is a throwback item.
Well, my mother loved a baked apple, and my wife a few weeks ago went to the market on Sunday and brought back, 100 apples, and we made baked apples, and then she kidded with me the whole week. Oh, you're going to have your baked apple, you old man on the couch watching sports with your baked apple? My mother loved a baked apple with a little heavy cream or half and half poured over the top.
Yep.
Cold.
Yep. Yep.
Oh, my God.
Exactly.
That was like a luxury item in our house.
Exactly. Indian pudding. You ever make Indian pudding?
Not really, but I've heard you talk about it. It's corn in it, right?
That is something for New Englanders. That's a New England thing. It's a cornmeal molasses pudding. I mean, if these people carry on about that fakakta bread pudding at Keeneland, for God's sakes.
I know.
Which I don't get at all, but...
Steve, I was in Keeneland with Mark and Steve for Breeders' Cup weekend, and I came back to our table, I think Friday afternoon or Saturday, and I brought back the world-famous bread pudding at Keeneland that they're selling in the grandstand. And I have to tell you, it was phenomenal.
I'm not a huge bread pudding guy.
I don't make it. I don't eat it. But I have to tell you,
they had
a bourbon creme anglaise that went over the top, and this thing was money.
Yeah. All right. For me, it's like a it's like a mushy glazed donut.
I hear you.
To me, it's a complete mystery.
I agree. In Flatbush, the Jews, the middle class Jews in Flatbush, never had an Indian pudding.
Well, no.
We had a chocolate pudding
with the skin on top. Put the wax paper.
Skin on top, of course. Jello chocolate pudding.
Mighty fine. Mighty fine. Mighty fine.
Yep.
I got one last question. It looks
good.
Like Neil. I thought we were doing a half hour, turned into an hour.
Wow!
This I've come from our friend Smokin' Joe McKay, who is quite a food impresario in his own right. But he's asking, do you make the gravy with the roux the next day after you make the stock, and use the cold fat from the top of the stock?
No and yes. I usually make the gravy the day that I'm roasting the turkey. I'm making the stock beforehand, a couple of days before.
Right.
I'm using the fat from the turkey drippings or chicken fat or butter, and I'm making my roux. Then I'm whisking my roux into the heated stock. And then I'm adding any of the leftover vegetables from the bottom of the turkey pan into that. And I'm simmering it on the stove all afternoon. And then, as I said before, I'm straining it and then putting it back on the stove, skimming any of the impurities off the top, reseasoning, looking at it, tasting it, dipping my spoon in it, and then seeing if it coats the back of the spoon. And then I'm not even putting it in a container. I'm taking that strained gravy with a ladle and pouring it right into the gravy boat right on the table. And it's been hot and it's on a low, slow and slow all afternoon. And I don't think you're going to go wrong.
Nice. A couple quick hits too. Sweet potato pie. Yay or nay?
I mean, I can appreciate it and I like to eat a slice, but I'm not a big maker of it.
Fair enough. All right. Macaroni.
Only because we have sweet potatoes on the table all the time,
there
you know?
There you go. Yep. Macaroni and cheese.
We make macaroni and cheese at the bakery. It's a big seller. I love it. My daughter, Jade, loves it. At Thanksgiving, too many carbs.
All right. It's big. It's certainly big in wide swaths of communities.
I get it. I get it.
I'm curious. I've never done it, but I take that back. Tina did make a mac and cheese 1 year because we had kids. We had a bunch of children, and so she wanted that as an option. And plenty of the adults slapped it on there. So
I'm not against it. I am definitely not against it. I just don't do it.
I got you.
Because I have it on our menu every day, so if I need mac and cheese, I need a fix, I'll have a little.
I hear you. What's your corn pudding policy?
I like a corn pudding once in a blue moon, but not on Thanksgiving.
Ooh, I completely disagree. To me, it's the I absolutely has to be, and it has to be in my mother's blue Corningware, or actually the dance, not the Corningware, in the Dansk blue 2-quart container.
All right.
All right.
Make sure you don't drop that dish.
That's for sure. Coleslaw, coleslaw, yes or no?
Yes, for the day after. Are you kidding? Russian coleslaw and a sliced rye for turkey sandwiches the next day. Lower East Side sour pickles. I can't leave the house without that.
Mm. From the days
I love coleslaw. Dee Dee married me for my coleslaw, so I have to say yes.
My coleslaw, no doorknob. I'm no doorknob either. Neil,
don't tell me, Steve. Don't tell me you put raisins in the coleslaw, and I'll kill you.
Please.
Okay. Good. All right.
Jesus, raisins in the coleslaw. God.
All right.
That's that. Seth Merrow would put raisins in the coleslaw.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God, Neil. As always, yeah. This is it's invaluable. It's inspiring. It's a tradition like no other.
I didn't even think we were going to do it this year. But
what do you mean? Of course, we were going to. We wouldn't do it. Are you nuts?
I don't know. You never know.
Neil Kleinberg, everybody. Clinton Street Baking Company, locations around the world. Give everybody the locations quickly.
Well, we have only three now because of the pandemic. A few of them closed, but we have Clinton Street on the Lower East Side, our iconic flagship. We have Clinton Street Baking Company in the Time Out Market in Dumbo, Brooklyn. That's an amazing, unbelievable spot with amazing views. And then we have a Clinton Street in Tokyo that's celebrating our 10-year anniversary in Tokyo.
Love it.
And we have a few little things that have closed, like in Singapore, but we're probably going to be reopening another location in Singapore, and we're looking to do something to revitalize our location in Bangkok.
Very nice.
So we got enough.
You got enough. You're busy enough.
Right now, we got enough.
And Dee Dee's got commerce up at Columbia, right?
No, during the pandemic, we sold Community.
Not Commerce.
And we're after 13 years, we're very happy to get out of that. That was a concept that we created and developed together, and we had a great run for 13 years, and we sold it and got out.
Very, very good. I'm glad I asked.
But
the one and only Neil Kleinberg, watch for him at Aqueduct at any moment.
No, not these days, but soon.
All right. Neil, thank you.
All right.
Buddy. Wonderful.
Steve, you're the best. Thanks.
Thank you, buddy. Neil Kleinberg, folks, and Clinton Street Baking Company, and the annual Thanksgiving visit. Dave Hill is going to join us now, and we'll get another one of our increasingly popular visits. Every Dave Hill visit is popular, whatever the topic is, whether it's the vapors, whether it's Oaklawn, whether it's the NFL, and Dave joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. How are you?
I'm terrific, and I don't know if you were listening in to Neil. You must have been. You've probably been to Neil's place when you guys lived in Brooklyn. You must have come across the bridge to Clinton Street.
No, I can't say that I ever did.
Well, next time you're going into the city, we'll make arrangements.
Yeah.
All right.
I'd love to.
It's a deal. Well, I got a zillion things to do with you. We got a full docket. We got 25 minutes. First and foremost, tell everybody about Thanksgiving in Hot Springs.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm headed to Hot Springs this weekend. We're actually going to drive down. I don't know why we're doing that, but we're going to drive down.
That'll be delightful with the kids in the car.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I'll probably need my head examined after this is all over, but we haven't been down there in a while. Especially not for Thanksgiving, but, I'm going down this week. I'm going to run in the turkey trot, on Thanksgiving morning. But it's, Thanksgiving Hot Springs is nice. The weather should be pleasant, you know, good sweater weather. Yeah. get the Hill family together.
What are the favorites? What are the Hill family? What is Pam? What does she masterfully lay out?
Pie, lots of pies. My memories of Thanksgiving growing up was that there was a whole table of pies to choose from.
Wow. Like what? Like anything particularly unique? Like, you know, of course, in Kentucky, we got Derby pie and chess pie, that kind of thing.
You know, one of the things my mom used to make a lot for my dad was a chocolate roll, which is not a pie necessarily, but it was kind of it was pie adjacent, you know, kind of like a pie crust rolled around some chocolate that was baked like a pie. We used to have that every Thanksgiving, but you know, we're Southern, so lots of, you know, pecan pie, sweet potato pies, you know, those types of pies, meringue pies were popular, not so much fruity pies. And, you know, now I live in New York. I spend Thanksgiving with my wife's family and there's a lot of fruity pies up here, but, we went with the rich stuff.
I love it. And in terms of the centerpiece, all turkey, a little ham,
Definitely ham. You know, a honey sugar glazed ham spiral cut. Yeah, from Weldon's in Hot Springs.
Well, there you go. Are they still available? Weldon's still.
Shoot, yeah, yeah. That place has been around since before I was born. Yeah, they're still around.
Outstanding. So a big push up for Weldon's. It's funny. I knew to include ham, and I came very close. I've already got 38 pounds of poultry. I came very close to buying a ham yesterday.
I love a good spiral cut ham, a sweet, like, you know,
yeah.
a ham with a sweet glaze is what great on Thanksgiving.
Is there a turkey on the table too or no?
Sure. Of course.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Any other oddball game, like a lamb or anything?
No.
All right.
No, but I will tell you a real quick, funny story. When I, first started dating my now wife, the first time I went to, she invited me to her family's house for Thanksgiving. I thought about bringing something, so I got a turducken, and I made a turducken and brought that as like a gift. And they thought that it was the weirdest thing they'd ever laid eyes on. Nobody touched it. Nobody ate, even tried it. I had to eat the whole thing myself.
Popularized, of course, by John Madden. And now, I mean, it's part of the lexicon. It's, you know?
I think it's great. I like a turducken. You know, I think it's, and we've had it a few times down in Arkansas with my family, but Katie's family, they weren't ready for it.
They were horrified. Where'd she grow up?
New York.
In the city.
No, in Westchester.
Westchester.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. All right. Aristocrats.
Yeah.
Dave, I also not to dwell on family things. I did see where you had a home improvement project that really struck my fancy. You built a secret room, and I wondered. I was going to wonder aloud on Twitter to you if this is potentially in anticipation of your children befriending any bank robbers that need a hideout.
Look, my office where I work, right behind me was the bathroom on this floor. And I felt like I just got tired of being on Zooms and things like that and having children and whatnot running into the bathroom and behind me. And it always kind of bothered me that I had this unused wall. So I built a bookcase and made like a hidden, you know, one of the bookcases is like a hidden door to the bathroom now. So they'll still probably run into the bathroom while I'm on Zoom, but it'll look a lot cooler now than it did before.
And for those that missed the famous reveal that Dave offered on Twitter, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago, when somebody asked what's the strangest thing that ever happened that nobody would believe, remind everybody what that was, Dave.
Oh, well, it's quite a long story, and I don't know if we have time, but just a pretty good, funny story from when I was young, when one of my sister's friends committed an armed robbery and hid out in my closet from the police all night while the police searched my house. But it's a wild story. I told it on Twitter, and I'll tell it on your show again sometime maybe.
It's the greatest, absolute greatest, because it was the perfect definition of what the tweet called for, which is, you know, say something that's happened to you that no one would believe.
Yeah.
But yeah. But coming from you, 100% believable. That's the best part.
It's true.
Unbelievable.
We can all laugh about it in my family now.
Yeah.
Enough time has passed.
Statute of limitations passed.
Yeah. I hope. I didn't consult a lawyer before I tweeted it.
You should. You might have to start doing that before coming on. Let's talk about, well, this is one of those provisos that you see in crypto ads. Future success is no indication of future wins.
Bad success. Yeah. Had a bad week. You know, we don't have to dwell on it. But, yeah, went from a good week to a bad week. This was a crazy weekend. There were a lot of games that landed within a point or a half point, and so that really bothered me. But I was on both sides of that equation, right? I got a push where I was on the right side of the number that would have been a loss if I had bet it later in the week. So you know, sometimes I think we look at the games that we lose by a half point and get real annoyed, but we forget that those half points sometimes help us win games we probably shouldn't have won, too.
Well, that was Jacksonville, right?
Yeah. So Jacksonville, if I bet that later in the week, it would have been a loss, but I got a push instead.
Well, and you know, you previous week you were 10-2-1. It's not like you went 2-10-1. You just were a tick under 500.
Yeah, knock on wood, we haven't had we haven't gotten thumped yet, but the weeks that I've lost this season, I haven't had a single week this season where I lost by more than like a game, you know. So nice. I've been pretty close to 500 every week, and I've had one really big breakout week, which is what you want in a season. I mean, we're flipping coins here, so you know, over the course of the season, you want to stay close to 500, and if you can have one or two big weeks, then by the end of the season, that'll keep your percentage where it needs to be profitable. But I don't have any expectation that I'm going. I mean, they're making me pick every game.
Right.
You know.
Right.
I don't bet the money. My money I bet each week. I don't bet every game. But I have to pick every game in the paper. So it's very hard to keep a positive record when you have to pick every game. Some of these like games are unbettable, but I still have to pick somebody.
Well, and for our listeners, you know, you're well above 500. Last week was 2-3-1, but overall for the paper, 76-71-3. Just past the halfway point of the season. And before we dive into the games, Tennessee's at Green Bay tonight. Green Bay may have salvaged their season, or at least they've got a signature win they can hang their hat on from last week if things continue to be iffy. But I thought the story that emerged Monday night or even Sunday evening was worth you kind of addressing it, and that was the better who went into the Eagle Redskin game holding a parlay, a five parlay leg ticket, and the last leg was Sanders 110 or better yards, and who was it? FanDuel offered him a buyout, which he took wisely and cashed for $20,000+. Some thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have a bunch of thoughts on that. I mean, the first thing I'll say is that I think that that anytime a sports book is offering you a cash out price, it's a bad price, obviously. I mean, they're only going to offer you a price that's at a number that gives them positive EV. So they, you know, that means that whatever their cash out number they're offering you is less than what they believe your current ticket you're holding is worth. So, you know, people shouldn't make bets that they don't believe in, that they're going to cash out early for less than what the actual value of the bet is. Now, sometimes what happens is people make these bets where they make these giant parlays where the potential payout is so big relative to their bankroll that they have to cash out because they don't want the risk. And then I understand it, right? Then I say, yeah, take that cash out. If you don't want it, if it's not worth it to you to take that kind of risk, don't take it. But also maybe don't make those kinds of bets, you know, like don't put yourself in a position to have to make that choice, you know, bet within your bankroll and make bets that you believe in. I mean, if you made the bet the time you made the wager, you were willing to take the risk for the reward. So I kind of don't like the cash out offer, that such sort of system generally. It just lets the sports book off the hook when they're sitting on it lets them out of their liability to you. And I think it takes advantage of bettors who are sort of who make these like swing for the fences type parlays and whatnot. and then, you know, see that they can get out early. And think, one of the things I do to protect myself from having to make these tough calls is that if I'm going to bet a crazy parlay, it's going to just be on the Sunday games that are all playing at the same time, so that I don't even have the option to hit the cash out button. I don't ever make a parlay where I'm alive into Monday and into a Monday night game, and then I have a tough decision to make about whether I want to cash it out or not. That's how I protect myself from selling out to the sports books. But the other thing I don't like about this promotional kind of thing is that sports books will promote these stories about these big bets, but there's a great article in today's Washington Post. I retweeted it today, but Washington Post has an article today about sports books limiting customers and how, mm-hmm. you know, people who win money get limited. I think this is an important issue, especially as sports betting continues its expansion around the country, for people to pay attention to the fact that one of the people profiled in the story, a sports book is tweeting screenshots of his big bet that he made, his big prop win, kind of like the one that you brought up. But then saying, like, look at this guy, he won 50 G's. But then the very next day they put extreme limits on all of his, mm-hmm. his bets after that. So, you know, I really get annoyed that, like, sports books are using these promotions to say, look, you can win all this money, when the truth is, if you do happen to get lucky enough to win that money, you ain't going to do it again because they're going to flag your account. And I think it's gotten really out of hand how aggressive sports books have been about limiting winning accounts.
Well, and to the credit of savvy horse players, they made that point with the introduction of, you know, widespread gambling as it was hitting the states. They all, everybody, including Dinky, we're saying, watch what's going to happen here. And yeah. it's one of the reasons, honestly, Dave, it's one of the reasons I kept saying, you know, because I know there's been these naysayers about, well, it's going to overwhelm horse racing. Not so fast. Not so fast. We got a fighting chance. You always have a fighting chance as a horse player compared to, you know, the sharps on that front. So I understand the equation, and I did see the piece yesterday, FanDuel's, you know, where FanDuel's revenue's coming from, you know, compared to 2 years ago, etc. I get that. But the widespread introduction of sports gambling, it doesn't doom horse racing, at least in my way of thinking.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things we benefit from in the horse racing is that it's a completely different system where it's parimutuel and the winners split the losers' money. In sports betting, historically, the sports book is our opponent. We're making a bet with the sports book. Sports book takes on some risk, and bookmakers have always been willing to take that risk because they deal 11 to 10. And so if you get to deal 11 to 10, you're going to take a bet on any number of people want to bet. But these new sports books, they don't want any risk. They don't want to be a bettor on the other side. They would rather be like a parimutuel system. They want to only pay the winners with the losers' money and have enough left for themselves at the end of the day. And that model, I think, is just putting a stranglehold on people who want to bet big and want real action and don't want to just bet same game parlays at bad numbers every weekend and watch their money slowly, you know, leave their bank account and go into DraftKings.
There you go. Let's look at week 11 in the National Football League. Starting tonight, Tennessee and Green Bay.
I think Tennessee's my best bet of this week.
I think they
win straight up. So I'm betting this game. I'm going to I picked Tennessee in the paper. I think that Green Bay is still a worse team than Tennessee. They had a good win against the Cowboys. It was a little, you know, it wasn't the greatest game ever for the Cowboys. And, you know, if you look at it, Green Bay beat the Cowboys by just running the ball pretty heavy. I mean, I think their first seven or eight plays were all run plays, and they kind of kept this going the whole night. And they're, you know, they'd run and they'd do like these sort of dink and dunk passes, and it worked for them. They overwhelmed the Cowboys. Tennessee has the best running defense in the NFL, according to Football Outsiders, with DVOA. Right now, this week, Tennessee is considered the top run defense. So I don't think Green Bay's game plan they had for Dallas is going to work against Tennessee. And the flip side of that coin is that Tennessee depends a lot on their run game, and Green Bay has one of the worst running defenses in NFL. So we're going to see an interesting matchup here, and I think Tennessee wins. I know they're in Lambeau, and I think that's a factor. and you know, I that is one thing that worries me. But I'm high on this Titans team going forward. And I think tonight if they win, it'll be a big statement. But so I think they win straight up, but I would still take the points. And right now you can get 3.5. I picked them at 3. The line's moving against me, so obviously there's a lot of big money in the market that doesn't agree with me, but I'm taking a stand here. I like the Titans.
There it is. We'll call it a four hog. A four hog star play to Tennessee tonight at Green Bay, 8:15 on Prime. The 1 o'clock games Sunday.
The game that's the most interesting to me is a game I'm not sure if I want to bet. One of the things I said in the paper this morning is that it might be best just to stay away from this Buffalo Cleveland game because they're calling for thunder snow. And I don't think that's an, to me, snow doesn't create an interesting betting angle. It just makes me want to avoid the game because it means there's more turnovers. You know, it's both teams will be more prone to turnovers if the weather's really terrible. It'll be a fun game to watch, maybe a bad one to bet. But all things considered, I think that Buffalo covers this number. It's at 7.5 some places right now. So the number has really moved from 8. I think it went from 8 to 8.5. Where people, you know, Cleveland was getting money at 8. Now it's all the way back to 7.5. So the money is pinging around here. The real number probably is at 8. But I think Buffalo can clear 8. I think Buffalo can beat the Browns by 2 scores. And the weather, I don't think benefits either team. But I think it can create some volatility in the game that will help one of the teams randomly. And that makes me nervous about betting the game. But I do like Buffalo a lot.
And let me slip in one quick anecdote, just because from Eagle fan history, and go back about 10 years to the game where LeSean McCoy ran for, I don't know, 200 yards in a 28-20 Eagle victory over the Lions in a driving heavy snowstorm. So don't automatically assume that the 41.5 is not attainable as a over-under. And don't necessarily, you know, assume that, you know, some of the individuals over-unders are, you know, not achievable, particularly on the ground.
Yeah, I mean, people think that the angle on snow games is to play under, but the actual angle is probably to play over because under gets overbet.
There you
go. So the numbers get adjusted in the wrong direction because people think they have an angle. I mean, one of the things I said in the paper this morning is the weather is not a secret. Everybody knows it, including the bookmakers. So it's factored into the price already. So if you're betting under, you're probably making a bad bet even worse, and it might make over the move in a big snow game. Yeah,
41.5 right now. All right, give us our standard 3 or 4 other prime plays.
I'm gonna play the Patriots at home, and that line right now, I think this is a good bet. And let me see if the line has moved. That line is now 3.5. I got it at 3 the day before yesterday, so obviously you can still find some 3s looking at the line, actually. It looks like you can find 3 at Caesars, points bet, but it's 3.5 at DraftBooks, DraftKings, and FanDuel, places like that. But I like the Patriots at home here against the Jets. One kind of weird play is I'm going to play New Orleans against the Rams. I think that the Rams should be in that game. They should cover the spread in theory, but I think losing Cooper Kupp is going to be a big deal here. And so even though New Orleans has really been stinking it up and at some point I should get off this team, I don't know that this is the week for playing the Rams. So I'm playing New Orleans in that game, and I'm nervous about that one because by the numbers I don't have them covering, but I think the Kupp thing makes me lean New Orleans. I'm taking Cincinnati on the road in Pittsburgh, which is tough because they got to lay points on the road. But I think that they can cover that one. And let's see if that number has moved as well to
4.5.
4. It's 4.5, 4. So you can. There's even a 3.5 at FanDuel right now, a juiced 3.5 on Cincinnati. So if you want to lay 115, laying 3.5, you can get that at FanDuel. Which I like a lot. And then my last play I'll give you guys is Arizona at home on Monday night, covering the spread, which is
8.5
points now. It was 8.5 when I got it. It's moved to 8 at a lot of places. You can you can still find an 8.5 at Pinnacle if you are savvy enough to have an account there. Oh, FanDuel's got 8.5 too. It looks like it's juiced on the Arizona side, which makes me feel good about it. So, yeah, the Cardinals, 8.5 points. I think they get that done at home against a team, a very impressive 49ers team, who I'm really high on for the rest of the season. But we'll see. It also depends on who's going to play quarterback in that game too. So that Colt McCoy looked all right.
Yeah. Huh. Outstanding. Dave's plays this week starts out big tonight, but now that he's broken his Thursday night streak, he's riding high with the Titans tonight, and then the Pats over the Jets, New Orleans over the Rams, and Cincy going into Three Rivers, and I don't think they play there anymore, and the Cardinals on Monday night with the Niners coming to town. Dave, this was wonderful. I think we're probably going to – well, we got to get a Thanksgiving visit in, or at the very least, I'll be back on the air Friday, so maybe we'll miss Thanksgiving, but I'll tweet out whatever you're – you know, when's the column going to show up for Thursday? Wednesday?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure how they're going to do that.
Good question. All right. Something you can ask your editors. Dave Hill, everybody. Dave Hill, 77, the one and only. Thank you.
Thank you. See you guys.
Dave Hill, folks, is so great. And that's our show for this Thursday. A week from Thanksgiving, it's instantly a best of because Gary West was fabulous. Pat Cummings, he's always fabulous. He's a bit of a fabulist. Tony Black, the Neil Kleinberg annual Thanksgiving visit, which was supposed to be a half an hour, turned into an hour. And then Dave Hill. Closing out a terrific Thursday of hijinks and wackiness at the races, Sirius XM, at the Thanksgiving table, at the gridiron, at the parking lot, tailgating. Good luck if you're playing, everybody. Weekend preview at the races tomorrow with Marty McGee, Brad Free, Marcus Hirsch, every correspondent from the Daily Racing Forum. Talk to you tomorrow. Thanks.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet into equine health and safety. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions, and offer betting tips from action.